This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. President Trump's connections to his favorite TV network, Fox News, got even stronger this month with his appointment of Bill Shein to serve as Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications. When Roger Ailes was president of Fox News, Shein served as his vice president and was considered Ailes' enforcer. When Ailes was ousted after several women at Fox alleged he'd sexually harassed them, Shein became co-president of Fox. But then he was forced out for having helped enable a climate of sexual harassment in the Ailes era. Shein was named in at least 4 lawsuits filed against Ailes and the network. My guest is Gabriel Sherman, the author of a book about Roger Ailes and Fox called The Loudest Voice in the Room. Sherman's book is being developed into a miniseries for Showtime, starring Russell Crowe as Ailes. Sherman began writing about Fox News when he was national affairs editor at New York Magazine. He's now a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, covering the White House. Gabriel Sherman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
It seems unusual that a president would appoint someone who was let go from a TV network because of allegations that he helped cover up a climate of sexual harassment there. So what are the allegations about Bill Shein's role in the sexual harassment at Fox News in the Roger Ailes era?
Well, Terry, you know, Bill Shein for 20 years was Roger Ailes' closest deputy and executive. And Bill Shein has been named in numerous lawsuits that he had direct knowledge of sexual harassment claims filed by Fox News women against Roger Ailes and other senior employees at the network. And these credible allegations are that he not only covered up these allegations, but in some cases enabled them. And one of the most disturbing that comes to mind is a story that I reported in 2016 for New York Magazine about the case of former Fox News booker Lori Loon, who for years had a sexually and psychologically abusive relationship with Roger Ailes. And as Roger Ailes' deputy, it was Bill Shein's job to keep tabs on Lori Loon and prevent her from going public with these allegations that Ailes had abused her and blackmailed her into a sexual relationship. And I reported, and it was perhaps the most disturbing aspect of the story, was that Bill Shein arranged for her to be committed to a psychiatric institution when she had a nervous breakdown because Roger Ailes was worried about her going public. And Lori Loon alleged in our interviews that Bill Shein was also involved in monitoring her emails and her communications, again, very cult-like, to prevent her from speaking to outsiders. So circling back to your question, it's mind-boggling that someone with this amount of baggage who was too toxic for an institution like Fox News, which is sort of become a shorthand for a toxic company, would become one of the highest-ranking members of the federal government.
Does Shein have a pre-existing relationship with the president?
Bill Shein's relationship with Donald Trump is relatively new. I mean, it does go back years because Donald Trump had a regular call-in slot on Fox and Friends that Roger Ailes gave him going back to 2011. So Donald Trump was, before a political figure, he was a Fox News contributor. And Fox and Friends is a show that is produced, you know, Bill Shein was the executive in charge of that program. So they, you know, they sort of were familiar with each other. But the relationship really gained steam as Donald Trump secured the Republican presidential nomination and ultimately was elected president. And the conduit, really the connector that brought these two men together, is Sean Hannity. And it's impossible to have a conversation about Bill Shein and Donald Trump without really exploring Sean Hannity's role in becoming the de facto chief of staff of this White House and probably the most powerful political commentator in recent memory, which is sort of shocking because at Fox News, you know, Sean Hannity was almost left for dead during the Obama years. You know, his ratings were in decline. His show was moved from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., a less desirable hour. And with the ascension of Donald Trump and Sean Hannity's unabashed boosterism of Donald Trump, he has emerged as the most powerful figure at Fox News. He talks to the president on a daily basis, sometimes for an hour or more. Friends and confidants of both men talk about this kind of innate, intense bond between them. that Donald Trump uses Hannity's show to just have a relentless drumbeat of attack lines against his critics, especially the Robert Mueller investigation. And so it was Sean Hannity's support for Bill Shine that helped bring Shine into the inner sanctum of Trump world. And just going back as a bit more of context, when Bill Shine started at Fox News in 1996 as a young producer out of local news, his first assignment was to produce a fledgling Crossfire-style talk show called Hannity and Combs. And so Sean Hannity and Bill Shine really rose up through the ranks at Fox together. And friends of theirs describe their friendship as very close and that they, you know, refer to each other as their best friends.
I want to talk about Sean Hannity more a little bit later, but first I have a couple of other questions. President Trump has sexual harassment charges against him. And a couple of those cases, Stormy Daniels, Summer Zervos, those suits are making their way through the courts. Might Bill Shine be helpful to President Trump in navigating that, since Shine has worked, as you say, helping Roger Ailes when Ailes was accused of sexual harassment or assault?
I've been struck as a reporter who's written extensively about Fox News and Roger Ailes, and now covering this White House for Vanity Fair, I've been really struck by the parallels between the cultures of the two organizations. And in many ways, Bill Shine has gone from working for a megalomaniacal boss in Roger Ailes to going to working for the current president of the United States, Donald Trump. And they are very similar personalities. And I think Bill Shine has a lot to offer Donald Trump because of his experience helping Roger Ailes navigate a cascade of sexual harassment allegations, and not only allegations against Roger Ailes, but other high-profile members at Fox News. So I think Bill Shine has a toolkit. He knows how these scandals have been weathered in the past, and it seems to reason that he can be part of Donald Trump's war room when he has to deal with these in the future.
At the same time, you can argue that if President Trump is accused of sexual harassment, as he has been, it's not a good look to hire somebody who is accused of enabling a climate of sexual harassment.
I think that's true if you're applying kind of the norms and logic that have governed politicians in the past. I think with Donald Trump, it's an entirely different playbook. And I think a way of example of looking at that is looking at Donald Trump's support for Judge Roy Moore in the state of Alabama, who was credibly accused by multiple women of advances on underage women in the past. And many people would say, well, why would Donald Trump embrace such a toxic figure like Roy Moore? And the truth is that people around the president say that his only way to survive these sexual harassment allegations is to double down himself, to actually run towards the scandal, not away from it. And we're actually seeing that playing out in recent days with his unabashed support for Congressman Jim Jordan, who has been credibly accused of at least being aware of sexual abuse at Ohio State University and not doing anything to address it. And Donald Trump, I think, tweeted that he believes Jim Jordan 100%. He stands by him 100%. So bringing in people like Judge Roy Moore, Jim Jordan, and now Bill Shine, who have all of this baggage around sexual harassment and abuse in their pasts, it sort of shows that Donald Trump is not giving any daylight. He's not going to give an inch on this issue, and it's sort of thumbing his nose. I mentioned this the other day to somebody. It's a sort of a form of trolling of his critics to say, not only do I not care about these allegations, I'm going to surround myself with people who have the very same issues.
So Shine is now Deputy Chief of Staff. That's the position that had formerly been called White House Communications Director. His official function will be to handle communications. Do you know if he will be having direct contact with the press?
That is a great question, and I think it's too early to say. I mean, he has not, to my knowledge, done an on-the-record interview since getting this appointment. And at Fox News, notably, Bill Shine had almost zero contact with the press. He was sort of trained and inculcated by Roger Ailes to think that journalists were the enemy. And in my dealings with Shine, when I was reporting my book, I had nothing but, you know, a few and very hostile exchanges with him. So it's going to be interesting to see how he reacts in this new role, where part of his brief should be historically engaging with the National Press Corps and shaping and helping to communicate the White House's message. I don't think that's going to be a big part of his role. My sense is that he's going to, his primary constituency is the president. He's going to try to translate the president's ideas and impulses into something that the White House can put together as a message. Bill Shine's first major assignment was to produce the rollout of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And he brought in a new set of stage lights and positioned the lights differently to improve the president's look on camera. So part of his job will be messaging, and the other part of his job will be stagecraft and production. And one thing Fox News was known for, whatever you think of the network's style or politics, is it was the sharpest and best produced of all the three cable networks. And so I think he's going to bring some of those values to the White House.
So one of his goals, according to your reporting, one of Shine's goals is to stop leaks coming from the White House. And there's certainly been plenty of them. Do you know anything about how he plans to do that?
From talking to people who have gauged his early plans for his new job, I mean, they talk about him really kicking the tires of the press shop. I think trying to suss out who is loyal to the president and who is not. You know, the White House has been for months now talking about a complete restructuring of the White House communications department and flushing out and firing people that deemed to be disloyal to the president. They've so far failed to do that. And I think one of the reasons Donald Trump brought Bill Shine in is he wants him to evaluate who should be voted off the island. And so I think that's also going to be happening in the days and weeks ahead. You know, one of the problems Shine is going to have, though, in his mission to enforce discipline and stop leaks is that working for the federal government, there are rules and regulations of really what you can do. And, you know, at Fox News, the employees always felt that there were cameras around the offices, that their emails were being monitored, that private investigators may be tailing them. You know, there really was this culture of fear, this almost Scientology-like culture of control that Ailes was able to create. And all the employees signed very draconian non-disclosure agreements, and the network made clear that they would sue to enforce them. Now, the White House is a federal agency, and you don't work for Donald Trump. You work for the United States government. You work for the American people. And so Bill Shine's not going to have some of those tools at his disposal to leverage the fear and control to keep people in line.
Brian Stelter, who's the media correspondent for CNN and has a Sunday show called Reliable Sources about the media, has talked about what he describes as the feedback loop between Fox and Trump, where a Fox host or reporter says something and sometimes that thing isn't true. Trump repeats it on Twitter or in a speech, and then Fox reports on it, creating this whole feedback loop of things that sometimes are not true.
Exactly. And, you know, I've written how in the wake of Ailes' departure from Fox News, you know, there was a real power vacuum. And I made an argument in a piece for Vanity Fair that Donald Trump really became the executive producer of Fox News. It's not only Sean Hannity that he speaks to. You know, Donald Trump has on his phone list, you know, the numbers of many of the prominent Fox News personalities, and he will call them to suggest story ideas or to compliment them. And when they go on the air, they are thinking of ways to speak directly to the president. And so there is this really kind of bizarre and surreal dynamic that the president of the United States is the executive producer, the head of one of the three cable news networks who exists to promote his agenda. And so, yes, I think it's more than a feedback loop. I think it's, you know, basically one organization. There's almost no daylight now between the agenda of the White House and the agenda of Fox News. And I think that is a development that is both new and from my vantage point, slightly frightening in American politics.
What do you find frightening about it?
Well, what I find frightening about it is that we have a situation in which there's a sizable portion of the American public, whatever Robert Mueller comes up with or whatever other sort of outside source of information is presented that is contradictory to the goals of this president, they will simply not believe it. You know, I was reporting a piece and I attended the president's rally in Duluth, Minnesota several days ago. And, you know, just being in the hockey arena with thousands of the most loyal Trump supporters and they're hanging on every word, It really is a case of a sort of a cult of personality. And one of the ways cults are maintained is having a shared information source and belief system. And Fox News has such a hold over the Republican Party. You know, the statistics show that a sizable percentage, I don't have the specific number, but a very sizable percentage of Republican Party base voters, their primary source of news is Fox News. And so this is one of the key reasons that I believe we have seen Republican politicians, especially in Congress, people like Speaker Paul Ryan, reluctant to challenge Donald Trump on some of his most outrageous and incendiary actions, whether it's the travel ban, the child separation policy, because the politicians know that the base of the party is getting a daily supply of programming that says that Donald Trump can do no wrong. And so the grip that Fox News has on the base of the Republican Party gives Donald Trump tremendous power. Yes, of course, there's CNN, there's the New York Times, Washington Post, there's a whole variety of other media. But when one of the political party's voters are told on a daily basis not to believe that, it really has an outsized effect on our political system. And so that's why I think the sort of state media analogy actually holds some validity because of the political effects that Fox has on keeping the Republican Party in line behind Donald Trump. I mean, I've had, you know, very significant Republicans tell me in private that if Fox News broke from Donald Trump, you know, you would see people on Capitol Hill also feeling comfortable breaking with him. But they don't want to do that because they know that the Fox News audience will be told that they are turncoats, they are disloyal. I mean, there are examples of the politicians that have broke with Donald Trump. They've been demonized on places like Fox News and subsequently have been basically railroaded out of the Republican Party.
Nevertheless, you report that one Fox executive told you that when Trump calls in, he's sort of viewed as this crazy person who calls all the time.
That's a common refrain you hear from people who either work for Donald Trump or have contact with him. His power doesn't mean they respect him. And as you mentioned, his speech patterns are often incoherent. But that said, being loyal to him and promoting programming that channels his message is very good business. You know, a lot of the people that work at Fox News are not necessarily right-wing ideologues. You know, I've interviewed, you know, liberal Democrats who just think of it as a job and sometimes a very well-paying job. So, you know, when you are a television producer, you live and die by your ratings. Those ratings determine whether you get to live another day. And so if you know that programming a segment that is helpful to Donald Trump is going to hold your audience or expand your audience, you're just going to have that constant motivation to do that. And I've interviewed Fox News producers who told me that the times that they did segments that were critical of Donald Trump, the ratings would go down. Yes, I think there's certainly an element of that eye rolling at Fox that Trump can, you know, be pretty insane. But at the end of the day, everyone knows that he is the major thing propping up their ratings.
Let's talk about Sean Hannity's relationship with President Trump. You've talked about how Bill Shine was Sean Hannity's producer in the early days when Hannity co-hosted a show called Hannity and Holmes on Fox, in which Hannity was the conservative and Holmes was the liberal, and they would discuss the issues of the day from opposite points of view. So Hannity has become very close to President Trump. How would you describe their relationship now? How much do they communicate?
Well, I was speaking just yesterday to a very prominent Trump advisor who was just remarking on the intensity of the Trump-Hannity relationship. And I was told they speak almost daily after Hannity's show, sometimes before, and they sometimes for up to an hour a day. And Hannity has become a de facto chief advisor, strategist, / chief of staff. I mean, he recommends ideas, policy ideas, communications ideas to the president. And just the other day, I was told by someone who had spoken with Hannity that Hannity has been telling the president that the moment that Robert Mueller issues his report to the Justice Department on the obstruction of justice case that has been reportedly he's supposed to deliver this summer prior to the midterm elections, that Hannity has been telling the president that that is the moment he needs to fire Robert Mueller and Ron Rosenstein, because he can then go to the public and say, oh, well, this is an obstruction. I waited till they delivered the report, and now this witch hunt needs to end. So that's in a case where Hannity really is indulging the president's most combative and, in some cases, self-destructive impulses. And it is just really, you know, remarkable, because for much of his time at Fox News, Hannity was something of an internal punchline for being a GOP hack of just repeating talking points. And, you know, his show was moved after the 2012 election from 9 p.m., which is a very desirable time slot, to 10 p.m., further down the lineup, because his ratings were softening. And it wasn't only until he decided to hitch himself to Donald Trump that he has had one of the most remarkable comebacks in television history, to the point where he is, I would say, amongst the most three or four most powerful people in America right now.
How often is President Trump on Sean Hannity's show?
He's given him multiple interviews. Also, Fox and Friends is a popular outlet for the president. But yes, he does grant Hannity interviews, and Hannity gets significant behind-the-scenes access. He was over at Donald Trump's golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey this past weekend. People who had lunch with him told me. And he enjoys being sort of an unofficial part of the president's West Wing staff. He plays golf with him, and there is just this back and forth. And one thing is I find so remarkable is that when Trump doesn't watch Hannity live, he will DVR the show and watch it the next day in the small annex room off of the Oval Office where he's installed televisions. And he likes to sit with all of his newspapers watching cable news. So he's probably one of the few people in America that actually TiVos Sean Hannity and likes to watch clips of it.
Well, Gabriel Sherman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gabriel Sherman is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair covering the White House. His book about Roger Ailes and Fox News is called The Loudest Voice in the Room. The new documentary, Three Identical Strangers, centers on triplets adopted from the same agency in the early 1960s by three different families, none of which knew about the others. Director Tim Wardle follows the story from the brothers' accidental discovery of one another in 1980 through the attempt in the 90s by journalist Lawrence Wright to unravel the whole story. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Three Identical Strangers is a puzzle documentary, and the more pieces the director, Tim Wardle, fills in, the more astonished you get. And the angrier, too, because what starts out as a parent trap-like lark becomes increasingly diabolical before your eyes. Robert Shaffron, Bobby, is the first of the film's narrators. In the late 70s, he was an incoming sophomore at an upstate New York college, where he was greeted effusively and even hugged by girls. They called Bobby Eddie, though. Then a guy he'd never seen came to his room and asked if he was adopted, and if his birthday was July 12, 1961. The answers were yes and yes. So the two of them jumped in a car and drove 4 hours to the Long Island home of one Eddie Galland.
His eyes are my eyes, and my eyes are his eyes, and it's true.
They looked exactly alike. They're duplicates of each other. There was no doubt in my mind that they were twins.
He's going, oh my God, I'm going, oh my God. He's going, holy crap, I'm going, holy crap.
They just looked at each other and they moved it. Every time Bobby moved his head, Eddie moved. And then Eddie would move and then Bobby would move. Like they were looking at a mirror. It was the weirdest thing.
It was like the world faded away. And it was just me and Eddie.
There are photos of this in the movie, of Bobby and Eddie staring at each other with absolute delight, and I'm betting you'll break into a grin yourself. Photos of the twins were all over the tabloids, one of them seen by a woman who recognized her friend David Kelman, identical brother number three. Here's the most exuberant sequence in Three Identical Strangers, a giddy montage of interviews with Phil Donahue, Jane Pauley, and others, narrated by journalists and relatives.
Reunited after 19 years.
We have a story about triplets that gives new meaning to the phrase long-lost brothers.
We went on everything. Everything.
You're not seeing double, you are perhaps in a moment going to be seeing triple.
I don't know who's who here. Come on out here, gentlemen. Come on
up. You just had to stop what you're doing and watch them on every different show.
It became a circus. It became a media circus. We're talking about viral. I mean, it was viral even then.
You guys have been on the front page of every newspaper in the world.
True.
People Magazine, Time Magazine, even the New York Times, Good Housekeeping.
David, let's begin with you. Which one's David? I keep forgetting.
You're Edward.
Right.
Okay, who are you?
You're David?
You're Robert. All right, Robert and Edward. Come on.
It was a fairy tale story. And people need to hear wonderful things.
It's a while into Three Identical Strangers before we hear the phrase that's obsessed so many of us, nature versus nurture. Do our genes determine who we'll turn out to be? Or is it how we were raised and what happened during childhood? I remember my college psychology books mentioning twin studies, kids reared apart who turned out to have uncanny similarities. And the more footage we see of the triplets moving in unison and finishing one another's sentences, the more we think, score one for nature. Bobby, Eddie, and David would move in together in the 80s and start a restaurant in Manhattan called Triplets, where the greeters and servers were all three of a kind. Wardle is a cunning storyteller. So cunning that he makes you wait through all the fun stuff before circling back to Louise Wise Services, said to be the preeminent Jewish adoption agency in the United States. Why did they give identical triplets to three different families without saying a word about the other two? It obviously wasn't a paperwork error. It was by design. But what design? Whose design? I shouldn't say too much more, though stopping here would give you no sense of the tragedy to come. The great New Yorker reporter Lawrence Wright enters the film to discuss his investigation in the 90s, incomplete by necessity, into the mysteries of the triplets, as well as several other pairs of separated twins from the Louise Wise agency. By the time Wright and Wardle get to a Dr. Strangelove-like Austrian Holocaust survivor and a government-funded study, you might want to exhume the phrase stranger than fiction. You have to look to paranoid sci-fi writers to find something comparable. One hint to what was going on is that the three brothers were raised in different kinds of families, one working class, one middle class, one upper middle class. Coincidence? And how about the fact that there was mental illness in their genes from the mother who gave them up? One more thing. The brothers don't look so much alike in later footage. Bob is drawn, balding, exceedingly grim. David is beefier and has hair. Eddie is absent. If nature dominated part one of Three Identical Strangers, in part two, nurture makes a comeback. Big time. Among the most upsetting parts of this story is that some of the puzzle pieces, the records connected to this study, will be sealed for another half century. But I'm betting that when more people see this knockout documentary, the official secrets will be harder to keep. There might still be identical strangers walking among us.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. My next guest, Paul Greenberg, has written a new book whose focus is omega-3 dietary supplements, capsules containing the fatty acids derived from fish and other sea life. He examines the claims the omega-3 industry makes about the health benefits of these supplements and what the latest research has to say. He also writes about the effect these supplements are having on the populations of fish harvested to create them and how this is affecting the ecosystems of our oceans. Greenberg is also the author of American Catch, and the James Beard Award-winning bestseller, Four Fish. Paul Greenberg, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So what are the health claims made by advocates of omega-3 supplements?
Basically, they fall into two categories. One is for cardiovascular health, and the other is for brain health. And within those two mega categories are sort of sub-things relating to joints. On one hand, vision is a part of it, because vision is sort of a subset of the brain. But I would say that if you really want to talk about omega-3 fatty acids, it's good to talk about the heart and the brain.
So how does omega-3 function in the human body, and why do we think we need more?
So in the heart, it seems to play a role in inflammation. Inflammation is sort of one of these boogeyman words that has entered the discourse around public health in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. And inflammation is actually a really serious problem. It's basically the body's reaction to infection. And when things don't subside after inflammation, you can have long-lasting effects of one kind or another. So when we talk about cardiovascular health, generally speaking, people who are pro-omega-3 tend to think that omega-3s reduce inflammation and thereby help our cardiovascular system be more resilient overall. In the brain, omega-3s are actually a major part of the human brain. Somewhere between 5 and 10% of the mass of the human brain is DHA, omega-3 fatty acid. So it seems to be directly involved in cell signaling. It seems to imply that a healthy amount of omega-3 fatty acid in the brain causes our brains to work faster. That's at least the theory anyway. It's hard to prove once and for all that that is actually happening, but that is, in fact, what people seem to suggest in the scientific community.
So what is omega-3?
So omega-3 fatty acids are found in seafood. They're also found in green leafy vegetables. There are different kinds of omega-3s, but basically what they are fats. And omega-3s differ from other fats in that they are what are called polyunsaturated. I won't go into the sort of details of how many carbon bonds they have and so forth. But what they are is they're much more fluid than other forms of saturated fat, for example. And they seem to impart a certain kind of flexibility to our cell membranes. And people who are really advocates of omega-3s, people that I sort of group together in the book as members of Omega World, people within Omega World think that this flexibility, this fluidity within omega-3s somehow gets imparted to our cell membranes and makes us similarly flexible and fluid and prone to resolving things like inflammation.
So what does the latest scientific research say about ingesting omega-3s through supplements?
Lately, not so many positive things. There have been these raft of studies that came out in the last, say, 10, 15 years, really coming to fruition in the last 5 years, that have shown really very limited effect, especially having to do with heart health. These large studies of studies that are also called meta-analyses. For example, one was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association back, I think, in 2012. And they found pretty much no effect on cardiovascular health at all from omega-3 supplements. The other side, the brain side of omega-3s, I think it's still kind of, we haven't seen these big studies come out that say very clearly one way or the other, does taking a supplement help our brain? The fact that omega-3s are 5 to 10% by mass of the human brain does imply that, gosh, you know, if so much of our brain is this essential fat, well, would more of it make our brains bigger and faster? And that's the assumption, but it's not necessarily being borne out by scientific research.
So does the human body absorb omega-3s equally well through a supplement or through fish when the omega-3 is within the fish itself?
My impression when talking to health professionals was that, generally speaking, it's better to get omega-3s in food form, just like it's better to get many different forms of nutrition in food rather than through a supplement. I think that the human body did not evolve to take, you know, isolated amounts of certain chemicals or certain vitamins or nutrients. We evolved to eat whole food. And I truly believe that if you're going to have omega-3s in your body, you should be having them through your food. What I think is interesting is that when you look at studies of indigenous people that live pretty far from the water, they look at health effects in people that don't eat a lot of seafood, but who generally live healthy lives, that eat a fair amount of vegetables, that are very physically active, that you don't see this market deficiency that the omega-3 industry warns us that we're going to see.
So you're concerned about what omega-3 supplements are doing to the ecosystems in the oceans, because the omega-3 supplements come from fish, or at least largely come from fish. So what are some of the main sources of the omega-3 supplements?
So omega-3 supplements come from this critical layer of the ocean biosphere that are small, what are called pelagic fish. They're the silvery little fish like anchovies and herring, another fish called menhaden that most people haven't heard of, but it's actually the most caught fish in the lower 48 of the United States. These fish are really essential for ecosystem dynamics in the ocean. So the way that oceans work is that all the energy is coming from the sun. It goes, all that energy is processed by plankton, by phytoplankton. And it's really these fish that are, these little fish that are used for omega-3 supplements that transfer the energy from plankton to larger fish. So in other words, this, you know, you have the solar energy going into the plankton. The little fish then eat the plankton, and then they are in turn eaten by larger fish. So if you harvest this middle layer, if you over-harvest this middle layer of anchovies, of herring, of menhaden, if you take them out of the picture, there's no way for the energy to be transferred from phytoplankton up to larger predators. I guess that's my main concern here. So in particular, where are the omega-3 supplements coming from? Most of the omega-3 supplement oil is coming from a fish called a Peruvian anchoveta. And it is the most caught fish in the world. In some years, Peruvian anchoveta harvests have equaled as much as 10 million metric tons. Just to give you some perspective, that's like 1/8 of all the fish caught in the world. And the crazy thing about it is that those fish are completely, totally edible. I've eaten them. They're delicious. You can have them on a pizza. You could do anything with them. But 99% of those Peruvian anchoveta are ground up into animal feed, boiled down into oil, and turned into supplements. So to me, to my mind, that is not necessarily the wisest use to be made of this really, really important source, both for the ecology of the ocean, but also for humans.
So these Peruvian anchoveta, are they anchovies?
Yeah, they're basically anchovies. They're in the same family as the anchovies that we all eat from the Mediterranean or off the coast of Africa. And yeah, it's just the only reason that we don't eat them is because this massive, what's called the reduction industry, has sort of cornered the market on them all. Now, I also think it's important not to necessarily blame the supplement industry for this, because really, omega-3 supplements are just the latest incarnation of the reduction industry trying to market their products. We've had a reduction industry around for 200 years, and actually the first target of the reduction industry was whales. And really, in the early 20th century, over 350,000 great whales in the Southern Ocean were reduced largely to make margarine. And remember all the time we were always hearing in the 60s and 70s that margarine was this great heart-healthy replacement for butter and all this kind of thing? Well, it turns out it's not true. And it also turns out that it was probably entirely unnecessary to reduce all of these great whales. Now, there used to be 400,000 great whales in the Southern Ocean. Now, there are probably less than 15,000. And all of it was because of this reduction industry. Today, obviously, we're not targeting whales for reduction, but instead we're targeting this major chunk of the ocean. Something like 20 to 25 million metric tons of fish are reduced each and every year. How much is it? That's like a quarter of all the fish that we catch, a quarter of all the fish that we catch that never hits a human plate. Most of it goes to feeding animals. Some of it goes to making fertilizer, and again, some of it goes to making omega-3 supplements.
So if a lot of the small fish that are being harvested in order to be reduced for animal feed and for supplements, what happens to the fish that eat those smaller fish that are being harvested?
The fish that are harvested by the supplement industry are keystone species. They are essential for growing larger fish. And if we remove those smaller fish from the system, then we're going to see fewer bigger fish. I mean, I think some of your listeners might remember the big cod crashes of the 1980s. And Mark Kurlansky famously wrote that book, Cod. And we all know about how we lost all these cod and we overfished them and so forth and so on. But what people don't generally know is that prior to the cod collapse, there was a huge assault on the prey base of cod on the Grand Banks. It's a fish called a capelin. Capelin are also oily fish. They are also used by the reduction industry. And it was really during the 70s and 80s as the animal feed business started to ramp up and started catching all those little fish that we started to see a real impact upon predators. And I did, when I was working on an earlier book, I did go back and interview some of the sources that Mark Kurlansky used for his book, Cod. And one of them I remember in particular in Canada said, you know, the overfishing of cod, it did occur, but look at all the little fish that we were catching. Look at how that may have affected the cod crash. And I, you know, he seemed to feel pretty strongly that the overharvest of those little fish could have had a very strong effect on that cod collapse.
So you wanted to find a way of eating fish that would be both good for you and for the ecosystem of the sea. So you went on this fish diet for a year where at every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, you had fish. Did you have things besides fish? Did you have fruits and vegetables and grains?
Yes, I had fruits, vegetables, and grains.
Okay. So it raised the level of omega-3s in your body.
Yep.
It also raised the level of mercury in your body, which is not a good thing.
No. No, in fact, actually, it went up to 5 parts per million. And it was funny, at the time, I was also working on a Frontline documentary, which covered some of the same material. And I remember we were interviewing somebody from the state of Alaska, which checks mercury levels, particularly in Inuit communities, because they do eat so much seafood, and they eat seals and they eat whales. But basically, I realized after that interview that if my hair sample, and they usually use a hair sample to determine history of mercury contamination, if my hair sample had ended up at the health lab in Anchorage, that they would have sent somebody out to my village and told me to stop eating so much blubber. So I had very high mercury levels. But curiously, when I went off of my fish diet, mercury levels dropped again, and now they're pretty much normal. And that kind of led me to this realization that there is a pathway forward, I think, to eating well for yourself and eating well for the ocean and eating well for the planet. And that's when I kind of came up with this idea of what I call a pescaterranean diet. Pescaterranean is like a Mediterranean diet is the diet that many clinicians have pointed to when they want to talk about an ideal human eating pattern. And basically what that means is very little animal protein, large amounts of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, olive oil as your principal fat. What I think makes the most sense is this pescaterranean diet. Very low levels of animal protein, talking maybe a couple servings a week. But if you made those servings particular kinds of seafood, you would both have really high nutrition, good levels of omega-3, but also have a much lower impact overall ecologically on the ocean and on the planet. So what are the seafoods that I include in this pescaterranean diet? Two things that I mainly focus on. One is these little forage fish, anchovies, herring. These fish are extremely high in omega-3 fatty acids, high in all sorts of other nutrients, and tend to be quite low in mercury, tend to be quite low in contaminants, because again, they're very low on the food chain. They don't have the mercury load that, say, a tuna would have. But it turns out that environmentally, harvesting an anchovy, harvesting a herring, requires very little carbon. There's very little carbon footprint because these fish are caught with nets that don't drag the bottom. So it actually is a way of getting animal protein on our plate without a huge carbon burden. And again, if we were to eat these fish instead of reducing them, I think we could cut the harvest and actually have this really, really great source of protein on our plates. The other thing that I've really incorporated into my diet are farmed bivalves, that is mussels, clams, oysters. Again, super high in omega-3 fatty acids, but also all kinds of other nutrients. And actually, mussels, clams, oysters, they actually improve the marine environment even as we grow them. They filter the water, they make the water cleaner, they actually provide structure for all sorts of other animals to exist. So I feel that a diet that mostly has vegetables and whole grains maybe at the base of the pyramid and then has a little bit of these forage fish, these sardines, anchovies, and so forth, and a fair amount of these filter feeders like mussels, clams, and oysters, that's about the best diet we can get both environmentally and from a health perspective.
You previously recommended something on our show that seemed counterintuitive, which is like buy the frozen salmon instead of the salmon that's sitting on the ice. I would always assume that, you know, the seemingly fresh salmon would be the way to go. So are you still recommending the frozen?
Well, generally speaking, yes. I mean, what most consumers don't know is that outside of the July-August window, anytime you see Alaskan salmon in the supermarket, it would have been previously frozen. So what a lot of times supermarkets will do is they'll buy the salmon frozen from the processors, defrost it, put it out on the ice, and it looks all beautiful and stuff, but it's already been frozen. And anytime you expose fish to air, you're exposing it to contamination and to, you know, degrading. So it's much better, rather than going to the fresh seafood case, if you want wild Alaska salmon, it's much better and much cheaper, actually, to go to the frozen section where you have vacuum-packed things like sockeye salmon that are, you know, really delicious. If you just defrost them overnight in the freezer, they come out really well. Also, from a carbon perspective, you know, if you're worried about your carbon footprint, frozen fish that is frozen on-site where they're caught are much lower carbon footprint than fresh fish. Fresh fish often have to be air freighted. And so you can imagine if you're flying fish around the world, that's very expensive from a carbon point of view. Frozen fish, once you bring it down to temperature, put it in the hold of a boat, it actually can stay at temperature without very little additional energy and can get to the consumer with a lot less carbon footprint.
Paul Greenberg, great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie. It was really fun.
Paul Greenberg is the author of the new book, The Omega Principle.